we're really talking of an improvement in the allocation of talent that just makes the pie bigger for everybody rather than just reshuffling jobs.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. If you're applying for a job, you really need to know what you're good at, and you need to be able to prove it to the recruiter. If you're on the other side doing the recruiting, you'll want some evidence about who the best candidates would be. In low and middle income countries, this information is often in short supply on both sides. So how does this affect who gets a job, and how does it affect the hiring process? In the latest in our collaborations with JPL to discuss their policy insights, I'm talking to Marianne Bertrand of Chicago Booth School. She's also co-chair of labour markets at JPL, and Stefano Caria of the University of Warwick about the impact of credible skills signals on employment. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks, both of you. Welcome, Marianne.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Welcome, Stefano.
Yeah, Tim, hello. It's great to be here.
Marianne, how big a problem is unemployment in low and middle income countries, especially youth unemployment?
Globally, the numbers that I see, about 200 million people around the world that are unemployed. The youth unemployment rate is about three times as large as the one of the general population. I think these numbers, 200 million, is very much an underestimate, right? Because that's people that are actively looking for work. I think in a lot of low-income countries, people have just given up, right? There's a very large share of labor force that's discouraged. So if you look at non-employment or underemployment, people that can't find, you know, a regular job and become self-employed, then the magnitudes of the problem is much, much larger.
And if someone wants a job, they're qualified to do that job, why, as I said in the introduction, do they struggle to prove that that's the case, that they are qualified?
You know, there's a market failure that comes from externalities, right? An employer kind of sees a potential worker, it's not clear on their forehead whether or not this person is going to be qualified for the job. And the best way to figure it out is to actually hire the person. And that's how this information gets discovered. The main issue is that that's costly for firm. They're going to have to hire workers. They're going to be failures because some people are not going to be able to perform. Some people are going to be good. They're going to want to retain those workers. The problem is when this information about the worker's quality become public, firms that has made investment in figuring out those skills is not going to be able to benefit from this investment. It's likely to lose the worker. That's the major market failure. It's quite similar to why we think firms are undersupplying general skills training, right? Employers pay the cost of this training, but the skills that the workers learn are relevant at other employers and not paying the cost of the training. So there's undersupply of general skills training. I think that's the core issue that we're facing here.
So when you have employers and they can't discover how skilled the applicants are or who is best to hire, what alternative strategies do they use to find someone to give the job to?
There's a range of tools that have been considered and used. So if you think about this issue of quality being particularly salient among younger workers, inexperienced workers, people have talked about using wage subsidies that are targeted at young people. There are environments where there's discussion of, say, applying a different minimum wage for inexperienced workers. You could think about some active labor market policies are also about being trying to address that, right? So especially in labor markets where firing workers is expensive, the introduction of short-term contracts, fixed-term contracts have been attempts to address this problem. And then there's what we are here to talk about today, trying to address this information asymmetry by providing the employers and really just the workers as well with more credible signals about their skills.
One strategy that we all know is that sometimes employers fall back on families and friends, people that they know, hiring from their social networks. We generally think of that as economists as a bad policy. But if someone gets the job and they're more or less suitable to it, how bad is it?
I think the use of referrals is very common, and it certainly helps to the extent that as a worker, you have somebody in mind that you think will be good for the job and you have this information. There are, I think, two main issues with too much reliance on referrals. They're based on social networks and there's homophily in social networks. So, for example, women are going to have a harder time. If most of the employees right now are men, women not being part of the social networks will not be referred for those jobs. The same would apply for younger workers if they're not part of the social networks of the older workers who are currently in the firm. In developing country setting, I think there's other issues with reliance on social networks that very often you have pressures that you receive from the home to suggest your brother-in-law for the job. Are you in trouble if you don't, you know, refer your brother-in-law, even though you think that he's just not going to be good at it? Referrals have advantages, but also some clear limitations.
And there's one more cost, really, which is that for young people, especially that are entering the labor market, the idea that unless they have the right connections, they're not going to land a job can be extremely discouraging. There is some evidence, and it's certainly intuitive, that people will invest less in their human capital, expecting that if they don't have the right network, it's going to be difficult to place that human capital in markets that don't function well.
So we're looking at the research on skills signals and how effective they are at solving this problem. What is a credible signal that you have a skill if you're applying for a job?
A credible signal is a signal that is standardized and that is given by a reputable institution. These two things are not always easy to achieve, but in many labor markets where researchers have worked in recent years, it was possible to identify reputable local providers of education, human capital, that then would naturally be trusted by employer when it came to testing workers and providing certificates. So for example, in Ethiopia, we work with the Addis Ababa School of Commerce. In one of my studies or some of the South African studies with a large NGO called Harambee. So these are all institutions that were pre-existing. So researchers didn't have to invent the institution from scratch. They could just leverage what was already out there.
In this policy brief, you're looking at the experimental evidence on how effective these are. What qualifies as an experiment? How do experiments try to discover whether this approach changes how well hiring is working?
Well, the basic experimental design is quite straightforward. You select a large number of people that you believe to be locked out of the market due to the lack of signals. So you think there is some potential in this workforce that is not being quite seen by employers. You test everybody so that you get an unbiased signal, an unbiased measure of the talent, the employability of each individual in your study. But then you produce the actual signal, the actual certificate for only half of your sample. By doing that, then you'll be able to track the employment outcomes, the job search patterns, the frustrations and successes of individuals over time. And you can attribute those differences to the impact of the intervention of the skill certificate.
And what are those outcomes? What do experimental results imply that credible signals change about, well, who gets invited to interview, who gets a job?
We put together this JPAL policy brief precisely because we felt that the literature came to a point where we could start drawing some conclusions. And it is actually the case that in most studies that have tried this type of policies, there are positive impacts on beneficiaries' labor market outcomes. So these impacts start at the point where individuals start looking for a job. Perhaps not widely recognized, but still tangible benefit of the signals is that they are a signal for the job seeker herself, for himself.
Right, yes.
So that's quite important. They can help the job seekers better target their own job search. Then when it comes to applying for jobs and getting jobs, we observe, for example, better conversion rates of application to interviews or application to offers. And finally, when it gets to outcomes, we observe, depending on the study, that the metrics tend to differ a little bit, but we observe a consistent pattern of positive effects. For example, increases in the share of people that are in formal employment or something that really matters to people, increases in earnings, which are a good indicator of the quality of the matches that are being created.
I think the experimental method that we use don't make it easy to identify the potential benefits for firms, but one can imagine that those are there as well, right? So to the extent that if it's easier to find the right workers, create the good matches, that this implies reduced turnover, all these should be beneficial to firms, would reduce their cost, may increase worker productivity. So we don't have yet the evidence to document impacts on firms, but theoretically, I think they should be there. How large they are, I think, is more TBD.
I'm interested in that impact on the job seekers as well. Is it making them more ambitious or less ambitious or in some way more realistic?
So this was perhaps one of the biggest worries that when I started on this research agenda myself, because you may imagine that doing this kind of test and telling people they're at the bottom of a distribution in a number of dimensions could certainly not be particularly encouraging for people. It turns out there are very few people that basically would score at the bottom of all the dimensions that are tested in the standardized test. And so that there is what some labor economists would call horizontal differentiation. Different people are able to do different things, mm-hmm. rather than vertical differentiation, where there are people who are just better at everything. It's much rather a case where getting a bit more information where you are in this different distribution can help you discover your comparative advantage, rather than a case of discovering, oh, I'm great at everything, or I'm bad at everything, and so I should just give up.
Do we know what the aggregate impact is on hiring? Are employers more confident, so therefore they hire more people, or does it just move around who gets the jobs? So there's the same number of jobs, but different people are getting them.
Well, that's a fundamental question as well. We do observe impacts on the duration of jobs. So that's a second indicator that firms are happier, or that both parties, in fact, are happier with the matches that are being created. So that's an initial indication that what is happening is not just benefiting job seekers, but it's benefiting firms. The moment the benefits start flowing to both sides of the market, then we're really talking of an improvement in the allocation of talent that just makes the pie bigger for everybody rather than just reshuffling jobs. So if firms are more productive, some of those gains will be passed on to other workers and so on. So there are initial indications that there are efficiency gains being made through these policies. There are two studies actually that try to improve the information about job seekers by using a firm level design. One was published recently and the other one is still a working paper. The one that has been published in AR Insights that finds that it's a combination of learning more about job seekers and having an expanded pool of job applicants that really enables firms to expand their hires. So the signals themselves are not enough, but are a key essential part of what it would take for firms to expand. The other study finds less encouraging results, but it targets a group of firms that are a bit smaller and that struggle to hire formal applicants in the first place. So it's interesting in that study that firms exposed to this information and to some incentive actually to post vacancies for people with better qualifications, but they don't get the applications back. So in a sense, it may take probably a comprehensive package that addresses the information asymmetries on both sides of the market for this to properly work.
Earlier, we were discussing how hiring using social networks can tend to exclude women and younger job seekers. Do we have any evidence that using these credible signals can help to bring them into the job market?
Yeah, there's been some research documenting that these skills and interventions or use of reference letters, which is another way to signal the skills, have been particularly beneficial to women. When you provide them, you provide women with this tool, they're more likely to take it up. So use it as they go and look for jobs. And it also seems like the prospective employers are more likely to consider women once they have these reference letters.
Can we make an argument for policymakers that in some way these programs are cost effective, that they pay for themselves?
That's one of the things that is most appealing about them. For example, there is an unpublished meta-analysis that tries to tell you what is the average effect of these policies on employment. And that gives a 3 percentage point increase in employment across sites. It's quite stable, mm-hmm. the size of the effect. Just to put that in context, the meta-analysis that try to quantify the impact of training give you an effect between 6, 7, 8 percentage points, depending on the meta-analysis that you pick and the type of training intervention that are considered in the time frame. But we're talking those kind of magnitudes. So it's about half of the impact of actually training people. But the cost is a fraction, maybe 1/10 of the cost. So 3 percentage points is clearly not revolutionary, but at the same time, in terms of return for money for the government, it's huge.
And just to be clear, these are the direct effects, right? So the effects are there, mm-hmm. they're much bigger than cost. They're also potential indirect effects or general economic effects that are not being captured by those studies. So once you have schemes in place that allow you to signal your skills more credibly, that may change people's investment in those skills. And the benefits of that should not be discounted, even though we can't quantify them yet, given the research that we have.
We've been thinking about a direct effect, which is the rewards for having skills, getting a job. But what about an indirect effect, which is what happens to people who do not have these skills? Is there an effect for them, or are we talking about a different set of policies?
We cannot answer that question with certainty yet, given the study designs that have been run so far.
But I think it's fair to say that there might be some kind of equity, efficiency considerations play a role here. So I think when Stefano kind of answered your question early on, he said, you should not be thinking about some people are skilled, some others are not. And there are some things that people are better at and people have comparative advantage. And the more information what we have about these skills, the easier it is to match people to the right job. So that's saying there's nothing to worry about. I do believe that there's a vertical dimension to skills. And once we get people to kind of stimulate skills, some people will be deemed as being less skilled than others. And that's the equity aspect, but we've been stressing the efficiency implications in the work. So I do think there's a potential trade-off.
Sure, not everybody's going to be as good at a particular skill, but a lot of these interventions shed light on skills that are not necessarily associated with investments that only the rich can make. Mm-hmm. So for example, soft skills are a core set of skills that employers worry about. It's actually a set of skills that is particularly hard to observe. So that's where this intervention can be most valuable. And soft skills are acquired in many, many different ways. Of course, the more affluent go to clubs and theater and things like that, but people of all sorts of walks of life can acquire soft skills in many, many ways. In our Ethiopia experiments, for example, there were many cases of people from less affluent backgrounds that had worked, for example, in family firms, in local shops and so on. And through that, they actually picked up a lot of valuable customer interaction skills. They never thought of those as actual skills that could be put on a CV or that could be observed and that could help them land a job, but they were skills nonetheless. So it is true that surely in terms of when it comes to, say, customer interaction, there'll be some people that are better and some people that are worse, but that will not always just correlate with people's family's income.
If these programs have positive effects and they seem to be good value, what would happen if we just scaled them up at a national level or a large regional level? Because after all, the problem of unemployment is not a local problem.
So one problem that would emerge is that all of a sudden, if you do not have a certificate, then employers may interpret that as a negative signal. Yeah. So the moment you scale that up, there is no escaping. And then you really need to be sure, I mean, this goes back to the discussion we just had, that the people who are not going to do particularly well are sufficiently protected, because there will be people at that bottom of the distribution. And the question is how many, but those few will need to be protected. At the same time, the upside is that the gains are probably extremely large. Mm-hmm. Misallocation of resources is likely to be very large in lots of low-income countries. The combination of having reasonable labor costs, probably a lot of investment in education at the same time, these high levels of youth unemployment really suggest that low-income countries and middle-income countries, to a lesser extent, are just not making the most of one of the most important assets, youth. And so unlocking that potential, it's what's at stake here.
The emerging evidence on this is very interesting, the policy implications as well. So thank you very much for writing the brief. Thank you very much for talking about it today. Thank you, Marianne.
Thank you, Tim.
And thank you, Stefano.
Thank you so much.
If you want to read the brief, it is called Improving Labour Market Outcomes Through Credible and Certifiable Skills Signals. You can find it at povertyactionlab.org. This has been a Vox Dev Talk, the best way to make sure you don't miss an episode. Subscribe. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are all at voxdev.org, where you'll find more information about the articles we feature. And if you enjoyed this episode, please tell someone else about it so then they can hear it too.